for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Through the centuries, the jungles of the Amazon have held many secrets. Among these is the 1996 discovery of a man believed to be the lone survivor of a once flourishing tribe. Journalist and writer Monty Real details how a team of experts ventured deep into the jungle to find and protect the last member of a tribe whose way of life has changed little since the Stone Age. Monty Real's new book is titled The Last of the Tribe, The Epic Quest to Save a Lone Man in the Amazon. The author joins me in the studio. I look forward to hearing from you as well. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to you, Monty. It's good to have you here.
Good morning to you, Diane. Thanks for having me.
Tell me how you first heard this story.
Yeah, I first heard about this in 2005. I was the South America correspondent for the Washington Post. And in Brasilia, the capital of Brazil, I met a man named Sidney Pozuelo. And Sidney at the time worked for Brazil's Indigenous Affairs Agency. It's called FUNAI. And his specialty was isolated or uncontacted tribes. And he was explaining to me that these tribes are generally very small, and they live essentially cut off from all contact with mainstream Brazilian society, or what we might call the modern world. And as he was explaining this, he said many of these tribes have been reduced in number. Some of these tribes only number a dozen now, some less. And he actually told me, in fact, there's one instance of a one-man tribe in the Amazon. And he said that the Brazilian government has been aware of his existence since 1996. And in the years after that, a small team of agents, field agents, experts in these tribes, launched numerous expeditions to try to find him.
Why?
To track him, to protect him from the advance of the outside world, because they believed he was in danger. In the area where he lives, it's Rondônia, which is a state near the Bolivian border in Brazil. And there's been an enormous amount of development, mostly agricultural development, that has really eaten away into the forest there. And for example, if you would have gone to that state in 1970, it would have been almost all unbroken rainforest. Today, full two-thirds of that rainforest has been destroyed. So a lot of these areas that once had been the habitat of isolated tribes, the modern world was encroaching, and they felt that if they didn't reach him first, someone else would. And so they launched these expeditions to try to track him, to contact him peacefully, and ultimately to try to protect him from this advance of the outside world.
The notion of an individual choosing to live in the rainforest totally alone seems so foreign to most of us. And yet, there's this photograph of this hut in which he lived. Was that the first thing that was sighted?
Yeah. What happened was there was a rumor going around among the loggers of the region. And that rumor basically said there's a wild man in the forest. We don't know anything about him, but he appears to be totally alone. And the members of this Brazilian government team tracked this rumor down to a particular logging camp and went out and met a company cook at that logging camp who said that he had seen a hut. And he led them into the forest to this, to a very small hut that they had found near one of the logging clearings. And this hut was big enough for one person to live in. And it appeared different than any that these experts had seen among any of the other tribes in the region. The distinguishing feature was that there was a hole in the middle of the hut that was about 5.5 feet deep and didn't appear to serve any practical purpose. But as they started tracking and trying to find him in this area, they found several of these huts. He was moving from hut to hut, and each one of them had the same hole.
Perhaps because he felt that someone was tracking him and therefore had to keep on the move.
Yeah, and he was hit, the direction he was going was essentially away from
deeper
the logging.
And deeper, Mm-hmm. What about other tribes? Had they also been tracked and contacted for their own good?
Yeah, in fact, what gave these team members some confidence when they started this tracking process was that just a few months before, in September of 1995, they had actually made first contact with two other tribes in the same region. One tribe had been reduced to 5 surviving members, and the other tribe had been reduced to 6. And the same team had gone out, made contact, peaceful contact with these two tribes. And actually, when they started looking for this single lone Indian, they actually recruited one of the members of the Kanaway tribe, which was one that they had just made contact with, to join them. And so this tribesman, his name is Pura, would go out on these expeditions with them. And the idea was that he would play almost a diplomatic role, that if they encountered him, that this man might be more open to receiving them if another tribesman like him were among that group.
You know, if I put myself into that lone tribesman's place, I say to myself, the last thing I want is contact with anyone. Mm-hmm. I want to continue to live as I am living. But how was he surviving?
It's really amazing to kind of think how much effort and labor goes into a really self-sufficient lifestyle like that. I had gone out during the reporting of this book and spent time among the Kanaway and the Akun Sioux, which are those two isolated tribes that it had been contacted just before this started. And I would go out, for example, with Pura into the forest as he would collect honey. And I knew this wouldn't be an easy process, but he would go out. He had to find a tree where bees had built a hive and where there was some wild honey growing. He actually, to get to that spot in the tree, he had to build a scaffold. So he made a riser and a platform out of bamboo. He had to go up on that, hack into the tree. To draw it out, he had to make his own sponge, which he did out of grasses. Rubbed it around inside the tree and then wrung out the honey. It was a process that took hours and hours and hours, and it was all for a little bit of honey, which wasn't nearly even the main part of one meal.
And where were the bees, by the way?
They were all over him. He was covered from head to toe in bees. So it was looking at those minor moments really made me kind of appreciate how much effort it takes to live a lifestyle in which you don't have any way to fall back on a larger civilization other than yourself.
The book we're talking about, if you've just joined us, is titled The Last of the Tribe. And my guest is former Washington Post journalist Monte Real. And if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. I keep thinking about the rights of this single human being, his rights to remain a single lone human being in that Amazon forest, to continue life as he knows it and obviously loves it, no matter how much effort it takes.
Yeah.
The last thing he would want is to be contacted by another human being because he's lived as he has. And his first reaction might be fight or flight.
Yeah, and you have to remember that although they don't know what happened to the rest of the tribe, they have a pretty good idea. soon after they started tracking him, they found the remains of an Indian village, and they found several different huts. I believe there were 14 different huts that had been leveled and destroyed and bulldozed. And under these huts, they found the exact same kind of hole that he builds in his individual huts. So they're pretty sure that this was the village that he came from. And in talking to local ranch hands there, they've determined that the people who cleared that land had encountered a tribe there and tried to chase them away. And the idea is that they were probably killed at that time. And that was in the beginning of 1996. So he's been completely alone since then. So there's, with that being the probable experience that he takes into this, encounters are naturally tense, if that's kind of what he would associate the outside world with.
How many people were in this Brazilian government search team?
It's been very small. Uh-huh. It's generally a team of really four or five people.
I see.
That have gone out and tracked him over the years.
Did you move with them at any point?
Yeah, I kind of came into the story later, but I did go out and travel with them in these areas and actually spent time in the territory that they've demarcated for this lone Indian. What they've done essentially is create a 31-square-mile reserve where the Indian lives sort of safely. And I went out there with them and stayed with them.
Monty Real, his new book is titled The Last of the Tribe. Do join us, 800-433-8850. And we're back. If you've just joined us, former Washington Post journalist Monty Real is with me. He has spent a number of years in Brazil. His new book is titled The Last of the Tribe, The Epic Quest to Save a Lone Man in the Amazon. Here's an email from Chris, who says, this reminds me of the tale of the last California Indian, chronicled by anthropologist Alfred Kroeber 80 years ago in Ishi in Two Worlds. Ishi died in about 3 years of TB. Can your guest comment on similarities and differences?
Yeah. As was mentioned, Ishi was the last uncontacted North American Indian, and he was discovered in 1911. And he really is one of the very few historical examples that compares to this. Ishi had been on his own for about 2.5 years before he was discovered, so not nearly as long as this lone man, but he had been alone for 2 years. And when he was discovered, it was interesting, he was basically taken in to Berkeley in the Bay Area in California, and anthropologists immediately began studying him. And he literally became something of a museum exhibit. He lived in an anthropology museum in California, and on Sundays, people could actually come into the museum and watch him. And what they would do, they would have him, for example, demonstrate how he made fire with rod drills and things like that. And so he quite literally became a museum exhibit. And the correspondent is right that he died very shortly after
of TB.
from tuberculosis.
Mm. Well, my question is about the Brazilian government agents. Were they benevolent, truly benevolent, in their efforts to try to find him?
Yeah, they started out and they really wanted, they had the idea that they wanted to protect him. But as they got into this, that became sort of an obsession, as it became more difficult and difficult to make contact with him. They began pursuing him harder. And a standoff occurred in 1998, 2 years after they started this, in which they essentially surrounded him in his hut. He was standing inside the hut, pointing an arrow that was notched into a bow at them. And the standoff lasted for hours and hours, and they were trying to convince him that they were friendly. They were offering him gifts, and
how
it was just going nowhere.
How many of them were there?
I believe there were four.
Four. Mm-hmm. All right. And they're surrounding him, but he's at the front of the hut.
He's inside
protected.
The hut.
I see.
He's inside the hut, but the hut's wall is just thatch, palm thatch, so the arrow can go through that.
Okay.
So he's pointing the arrow at them, and they're trying to communicate, but they don't speak his language. They don't know what language he speaks, even. They're trying different languages, different indigenous languages, and nothing seems to be working. And he actually ended up shooting an arrow at them, at a man who was documenting this with a video camera. And shortly after that standoff, the man who was videotaping this, his name is Vincent Corelli, he had a dream. And if you remember the old wildlife show, Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, they would sometimes go out in that show and they would have tranquilizer dart rifles. And they would be going through the jungle or the, you know, the plains of Africa, and they might shoot a lion with one of these tranquilizer darts, and that would allow them to inspect the animal up close. Well, in Vincent's dream, he shot the Indian with one of these tranquilizer darts and finally had the opportunity to get up close and personal with him. He woke up from this dream just horrified with himself that, you know, it had become very clear to him and the other members of the team that they were hunting him like a wild animal, and that not only was he on the run from the ranchers and the developers that were pushing in on his territory, he was also on the run from them. So very shortly after this, this team completely changed their strategy and decided to adopt a strict policy of no contact. And in this policy, basically what they're trying to do is create a safe zone for him. And if contact is made, it will be his decision. They will be on the edge of this territory, but they won't attempt to directly make contact with him. Mm. They'll let him be the one who initiates that. And that policy is actually, it's replicated in Brazil and is now the official policy for all of the isolated tribes in that country.
Monty, I want to go back to that moment when the subject is holding this arrow. And has it aimed at the camera, cameraman? Does he fire?
Yes.
And
he missed in that instance. But there were other instances later, because in the book there's a lot of opposition once this team decided to adopt this policy of no contact. There's a lot of opposition from the agricultural industry in the area that wants to develop this land. And actually the
piece of land that he is on.
Yeah, and it became kind of symbolic.
Wow.
So this team, the members of this team, actually went through nightmares of being attacked, just by their reputations being attacked, and they actually were transferred out of the area. So a new team came in. Other attempts to make contact with the Indian were tried. Then later, years later, with this new team that had taken over, and it was the same sort of motive. They thought that making contact with him was the only way to protect him from the people pushing in. And then there were other encounters, and those encounters ended somewhat the same way, but in these times he didn't miss with the arrow. He actually did shoot one of the members in the chest with an arrow. This team member didn't die, but he was injured by this.
That strikes me as reason to perhaps form a whole new process,
mm-hmm.
or back off completely,
yeah.
and let the guy do what he wants to do. This idea of protecting him becomes rather questionable.
It does. And what they ended up doing was they created an official indigenous territory, 31 square miles, and it's off limits to development. Basically, it's an Indian reserve for one man. And it's still very hotly debated there because ranchers and developers in that region look at a 31 square mile territory.
And they want it.
Well, their argument is that all this land is being reserved for the benefit of one man. If we develop it and make it a productive piece of real estate, it could be used for the benefit of hundreds or thousands if it produces, for example, cattle or crops or something like that.
But, Monty, what about the other tribes that were still extant there?
Mm-hmm.
Would they not have been able to share in this piece of property, or had they already been brought out?
The other tribes are a distance away. They're I think they're about 20 miles as the crow flies from him. And in between that, there are a lot of ranches and cleared forests. So it's really an island that he's on. And there's really no way that another tribe would kind of wander into that territory.
And do the other tribes have a piece of property similar?
Yes, they have. There's another territory in that region for them that's a protected zone, another indigenous territory.
So how does that compare with what the United States has done in terms of our own indigenous tribes?
Yeah, this is really an approach or a strategy that doesn't have any precedent if you compare it to other places in the world. The idea of no contact is it just goes against sort of the historical flow. Throughout history, when an expanding civilization pushes into new territory and encounters an indigenous population, it's been the same story forever. That indigenous population is assimilated into the larger one. And in Brazil, what they've done is basically looked at history and looked at the experiences that they've had there with these similar tribes like this. And they've noticed that it almost always ends badly, whenever, especially in cases where the tribes are so small. So basically, they've launched an experiment, and this is to try to put the power of determination in the hands of the tribe. And as I mentioned, there's still a lot of opposition to this. It's definitely a live debate. And, you know, it remains to be seen whether it will be a successful experiment or not.
And how much protection is there for those 31 acres and that one man?
Well, not a lot. And that's the big question, because there are a lot of laws in the Amazon, but enforcing those laws is a completely different story. In fact, in last November, the Funai encampment that they've set up on that 31-square-mile territory, basically that's an area where they can monitor the land and make sure outsiders aren't coming in. That encampment was destroyed, and shotgun shells were left there as a message that, you know, there's still a lot of people who don't like the idea of this. So they had to do another expedition as a sort of proof of life to make sure that the Indian was okay. And so late last year, they did that and found that he's still unharmed inside the territory.
Is there any way to judge how old he might be?
They think he's in his mid to late 40s. Mm-hmm. He appeared to be in his younger 30s when they first attempted to make contact with
and
him.
And have any of the anthropologists who've at least perhaps had a chance to observe, have any of them discerned what this hole might be for?
They've floated out a lot of different theories. He appears to sleep over it. Over it, yeah. It's not big enough for him to go down really into it and sleep, but he builds a sort of a stiff hammock over the hole. And so at first they thought maybe it was temperature control or something like that. But what they've generally come to agree upon is that they think it's spiritual, that it's a tradition that his tribe passed down, and that it doesn't really serve a practical purpose.
Monty Real, his new book is titled The Last of the Tribe, The Epic Quest to Save a Lone Man in the Amazon. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook. Join us on Twitter. And to Steve in suburban Maryland, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Monty, I can't wait to read the book. It sounds terrific. As a former anthro major, you'll probably hear from a lot of people like me, and it must have been very exciting. I have a question for you. You know, given the history of the, quote, discovery of the Tassaday and others, how have you decided that this person is from a single tribe and isn't simply part of another group that hived off either as an individual or long ago separated for other reasons? And then the second question is, what's happened to culture as these tribes have been reduced to individuals?
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the questions, both excellent questions. The first one, essentially they haven't ruled out anything in terms of his origin and what larger tribe he might have come from. They've gone round and round trying to connect him to other tribes that are known in both Brazil and Bolivia. There's another tribe called the Siriono in Bolivia that at first they thought he might have been someone who was separated from that tribe or was part of a sub-band of that tribe that had been reduced. But he uses a different kind of bow. The holes that he digs are different. So they don't believe that he is connected to that, and they just haven't found another tribe that is exactly like his. So for that reason, the anthropologists have kind of grouped him as a member of his own tribe, the last surviving member of a distinct tribe. The second question...
he asked what's happened to the tribe.
They don't really know. As I mentioned, they had found that village that had been destroyed. So they have been able to piece together the stories that the ranch hands have told. They believe that the rest of that tribe had been decimated by ranchers.
Just decimated. Mm-hmm. What kind of thought process, what kind of attitude has Brazil had, generally speaking, toward these Indians, toward these tribes?
It has changed a lot. In the 1970s and 80s, just in general terms, the government of Brazil launched a big program to try to populate the Amazon. At that time, the government was a military government, a military regime, and they encouraged people to move into the jungle to clear land and to make it productive to feed Brazil's economy. And they actually came up with a slogan for this particular area. They called it "A Land Without Men for Men Without Land." And they essentially gave away land. They sold it very, very cheap and encouraged people to move from the coasts. And a lot of people did. They moved into the Amazon, adopted what really is a harsh lifestyle, a frontier lifestyle, and tried to hack out an existence as farmers.
But what you're saying is that they were clearing the forest as they were moving in.
Yeah. And what happened was that after the military government was replaced by a democracy, the attitudes changed and the emphasis turned more to protection of the rainforest.
The book is titled The Last of the Tribe. Monty Real is the author. And after a short break, we'll take more of your calls.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of the last great chief of the Comanche Indian Nation. He was the son of a chief and a white woman. We talk with S.C. Gwynn, author of Empire of the Summer Moon. Also, Connie Britton, who plays Tammy Taylor, the coach's wife and West Dillon's high school principal, on Friday Night Lights. Join us.
And welcome back. Monty Real is with me. His last name, by the way, is spelled R-E-E-L. His book is titled The Last of the Tribe, The Epic Quest to Save a Lone Man in the Amazon. Let's go to San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
I'm South Texas Pachal Indian, and I wanted to make the comment, or at least let folks know who are listening to this show, that it'd be a good idea for folks to read Vine Deloria's books, Lakota Elder, who's passed on now, and I think that what he talks about is how it's very egocentric for folks to assume that we have invited strangers into our world to help us without asking. And I think that folks need to look very seriously into that issue, because it coming into those worlds uninvited that way is simply the beginning of encroachment and assimilation and so forth and so on. I'll just listen to comments on the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Gary.
Yeah, and this book essentially tells the story of how this team came to believe just that, that their efforts to contact him were misguided. And as I mentioned, they have developed this strategy to really put the power of determination in his hands. And if contact is made, he'll be the one to decide that. It really is a radical departure from the methods that other civilizations have used in dealing with those indigenous populations.
And he seems just fine right now.
Yeah. The last observation that they had made was a few months ago. They had gone out, and he appears to be settling down somewhat. Since they've made this reservation for him, he hasn't been on the run. And he appears to be living in the same hut for essentially permanently now. And they believe that his life has stabilized somewhat.
And the estimate is that he's about 45, 46 years old.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Here's an email from Hunter who says, I'm wondering what language this person spoke. Was it an indigenous language, Portuguese, both, or something else? I'm a student of linguistic anthropology and would love to hear your panelists talk about this person's language and perhaps its relationship to language death in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he almost certainly speaks an indigenous language. During the reporting of this book, I spoke to a linguist who has worked in this particular area of Brazil for decades. And it was really interesting to hear him talk about the languages spoken there. In Europe, for example, there's one isolate, and isolates are languages that don't share a common root with any other language, and that's the Basque language in Europe. In Rondônia, which is just this one state in Brazil, there are more than 10 isolates. And of more than 30 languages spoken in Rondônia, most of them are indigenous languages. Half of those have fewer than 50 speakers now. So these languages are just sort of fading away, literally, you know, decade by decade.
All right. And to Greg in Boston, Massachusetts. Good morning to you.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Diane and Monty. This is Greg in Boston. And, yeah, the book Ishi was published in 1961, and it was actually written by Theodora Kroeber, Alfred Kroeber, the anthologist's wife, the famous Alfred Kroeber. Unfortunately, it's an extremely sad story, and perhaps if they had left Ishi alone, he would have died naturally. However, he succumbed to white man's illnesses, and which is probably a very likely thing to happen to this gentleman in South America if he is, in fact, in contact with the local people. They just do not have the resistance to our illnesses. There is a section of Canada that has been set aside for the indigenous people. And also, I have a question. Are the Tassaday a real tribe? This has been a very controversial study. And also, I just want to say one other thing, and that is that most of us assume that the Indian wars are not over, and in the military sense, they are. However, it seems that the more powerful of us, be they through business, politics, mining interests, or whatever, are still at war with indigenous people, not only in the Americas, but all over the world. We still want what they have, whether they know they have it or not.
Greg, thanks for your call.
Yeah, the question of whether these tribes are real or not comes up a lot in Brazil as well with these isolated tribes. In fact, the existence of this man was questioned throughout the beginning of this search. And one of the reasons, one of the things that really propelled the team members to try to make contact was to prove that he actually existed, because stories would go around that it was just that he was a myth and he was the invention of people who didn't want that land developed. So there was a big motivation among these team members to try to document his presence. And so whenever they were surrounding that hut, whenever he was pointing the arrow at them, Vincent was filming him. One of his motivations was to get clear images of him to prove to people that this last tribesman really did exist. So that's an issue that still today in Brazil is a live issue. People want to prove that that uncontacted or isolated tribes still do exist.
Can we see those films?
Yes, there's actually on the Simon & Schuster website or my website, montyreal.com. You can see a video that we've put together with some clips of Vincent's footage. And the book itself has some pictures that came from that encounter.
And we will connect that to our own website, drshow.org. So if you go up there, we'll try to get that on as quickly as we can. What about Greg's other point, that the wars are really not over, that we, whoever we are, simply want what they, whoever they are, have?
Yeah, there's the argument that you'll hear, as I mentioned before, is this greater good argument. That saving this much land for one man doesn't make sense. They argue that it would serve more people if the land were developed. But I think that there's something embedded in that argument, a flawed assumption. And the assumption is that creating more productivity in the Amazon relies on new clearings. But anyone who travels around in the Amazon is going to encounter lots and lots of land that's already been cleared and is just sitting idle. So the notion that to increase productivity in the Amazon would require clearing either this part of land or any other, it really doesn't match the reality on the ground.
Greg, thanks for your call. Here's an email from Susan in Miami, Florida, who says, where was the Brazilian government's protection when developers in the Amazon region were building roads and destroying precious rainforests, slaughtering indigenous tribes in their way decades ago? Please ask your guest to discuss the work of Vilas Boas brothers, who gathered numerous tribes in the Mato Grosso in a similar attempt to save them some 40 years ago. My pronunciations may be terrible.
No. For years, Brazil's indigenous agency has sort of been at the whim of the political power structure in Brazil. And the agency has been fraught with many problems throughout the years. But as the writer had mentioned, there have been instances throughout Brazil's history of individual figures who have sort of emerged to really be advocates for the indigenous tribes. And the Vila Boas brothers, they created the first real national park in Brazil called Xingu, and it's an enormous tract of land. And they were anthropologists who really raised awareness for these issues involving the isolated or uncontacted tribes. And the man who introduced me to this story, Sidney Pozuelo, actually got his start working with the brothers, Orlando in particular, in Xingu. And in 1987, after the military government was replaced, Brazil rewrote its constitution and gave the indigenous groups a lot more rights. And Sidney actually convinced FUNAI, the indigenous agency, to create a special division devoted solely to the protection of these isolated groups. So it was that there is sort of a connection to the Vilas Boas brothers in these modern figures that have also emerged to try to protect the tribes.
All right. To St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Amanda.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I should mention I was able to get a copy of Monty's book at a book signing here a couple of weeks ago, but the minute I got home, my mom took it. So. She's reading it now, and I expect I'll find the answer to this question when I get to. But, Monty, I wanted to know if you have a sense of what the Indian sense is of the relationship between himself and the outside world, I guess as represented by this team of folks who have been trying to make contact with him. Has there ever been real communication to sort of explain their intent?
They have tried, and they believe that he is more understanding now of their intent. They've repeatedly tried to express to him in any way that they can that they don't intend to do him harm. But it seems that the most effective way of doing that has been to leave him alone. He has been more stable whenever they give him more space. And it's interesting, just before the team members changed and the new group came in that tried to, again, reassert contact, forced contact with him, they believed that they were making a lot of progress. And one of the members of the team, his name is Paolo, was out walking in the forest one day and actually saw a new hut of the Indian. And he, you know, noted the hut and was actually happy that he seemed to be in a stable enough place to build a new one. And he continued to walk on, and he heard a voice, and it was just a shout, "Ho!" And Paolo stopped and froze, and he looked, and he saw the Indian. And the Indian just quickly disappeared. He ducked behind a tree, didn't run, but just kind of disappeared. And Paolo looked down, and in front of him was a spiked bottom pitfall that the Indian had constructed to try to trap game. So this was about 5.5 feet deep, 5 or 6 feet deep, and at the bottom there were spikes that were put in there. The idea is that if a wild pig or another large animal comes by, it'll fall in there, and it's a way of hunting.
And the Indian was warning him.
Was warning him. And so this was a sign to them that their relationship had kind of developed somewhat, and that they believe they had an understanding. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, shortly after that, the new team came in, and contact was attempted again, ended disastrously.
How so?
With an arrow being shot at one of the team members.
Oh, dear.
And, you know, that reconvinced everyone within the Brazilian government that a hands-off approach was best.
Amanda, thanks for your call. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Monty, did you actually lay eyes on this man?
No, because as I've mentioned, the policy now is to, if contact is made, it'll be his decision. I went out to this area and stayed in the Funai encampment inside that 31 square mile territory where he lives. But the way that they have it set up now is that they won't actively hunt or try to make contact with him unless, as happened whenever their encampment was destroyed, unless they believe there's an imminent threat to his life. So I went out there with them, but during that period, we didn't actually have any contact with
him. And do you believe that at this point, individuals who might want that land could threaten his life?
It's always a possibility, but I think the more people kind of are aware of the story and are aware of the situation there, actually the safer he will be, because they believe, the Brazilian government actually believes, that if he's sort of forgotten out there, that opens the door for anyone to kind of come in and try to get away with something.
To Windsor, Ohio. Hi there, Harmon. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. In addition to other arguments against the idea of the greater good is the fact that to displace this man would be murder and destruction of an entire culture. Thank you.
You believe that as well.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that, you know, there's been so many instances of tribes in Brazil and in other countries that have been decimated, really reading through the histories of Indians in the 20th century there. It's just one story of decimation after another. And I think in this case that, you know, they're trying something different, and I think it's really a worthy experiment.
Do the citizens of that area know of this man? Have they read stories about him in newspapers and the like? Is there a certain sympathy for him?
Well, a lot of them do know about it in this particular area. It has been something that's been discussed over the years. But you have to remember that almost all of the people who moved out to this area moved out to be part of the developmental industry. So there's a lot of animosity towards anyone who has sort of a motive of going against the grain of development there. The local politicians, the senators, the governors, the mayors, almost uniformly are parts of that industry because that's the people who settled there.
And Monty Real's book is titled The Last of the Tribe, The Epic Quest to Save a Lone Man in the Amazon. Do you believe he will stay safe?
I hope so. It's impossible to predict, but I hope so.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.